Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show. I'm your host, Josh Fennett. On today's show, we're privileged to share a few tall tales with one of the last great modernist architects.
We have a deep social responsibility, and if you're an architect, then your calling is to make the environment better. It's not a license to just be an expressive artist.
Israeli-Canadian maestro Moshe Safdie is the man behind the blocky Habitat 67 building in Montreal, plus the curving three-tiered Marina Bay Sands structure in Singapore. He reflects on his life and work. Then we speak to Mark Ovenden about his new book on the influence of British typographers Edward Johnson and Eric Gill.
Within 10 years, it was virtually everywhere. Printers all over Britain had trays full of this metal Gill Sands type and on their monotype machines.
And finally, we head to Cannes on France's Twinkling Côte d'Azur to sample that rarest of delights, a bearable trade show booth. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Welcome to the show. Now, the Israeli-Canadian architect Moshe Safdie is behind some of the most striking buildings constructed over the past few decades, from the US to Israel and in India and Singapore too. His signature geometric style with lashings of lavish curves and a bit of green space to boot have made the self-styled modernist an influential voice in the industry. Now, Safdie shocked and delighted in equal measure in 1967 with the construction of Habitat 67 in Montreal. The staggered housing complex that might best be described to listeners as looking like a piled high assembly of interlaced shoeboxes is one of his best known works and grapples with the still problematic notions of both communal living and housing density. Monocle's very own Jason Lee sat down with Safdie at another one of the architect's most striking projects to date, the Marina Bay Sands Complex in Singapore. The building is comprised of three skyscrapers connected by a curved boat-shaped cap, looking something like a three-legged pie symbol to the uninitiated. It's become a bold bellwether of Singapore's architectural turn. The pair nattered about how urban density continues to pose questions a half century since Habitat 67 was built, and how Safdie's worldview was shaped by his early life growing up in a kibbutz in Israel.
I grew up in Israel. I was born in what was Palestine, then became Israel. I grew up in Haifa and spent much of my time on the kibbutz, but particularly summers where we worked in the kibbutz. It was a very idealistic time. It was Israel in the making. It was a kind of a socialism of the kibbutz movement, of the cooperative movement, of egalitarianism. And I grew up just immersed with a sense that we could make the world better, that's before I even thought about architecture, that we have a responsibility to the community. And it was really all very beautiful. Then I found myself transplanted to Canada. Studying agriculture to be a kibbutz member didn't make much sense, and it dawned on me that I really loved sketching buildings and cars and designing, and I decided to be an architect. But the underlying sort of theme in my own belief system as an architect, as a person, I suppose, is that we have a deep social responsibility. And if you're an architect, then your calling is to make the environment better, to build buildings that uplift people's spirit, that are wholesome. It's not a license to just be an expressive artist, all about your own ego and all that. But actually, if you are an artist, it is while performing a social responsibility.
And can we talk a little bit about Habitat 67? It kind of captures a lot of this community feel, even though it's an apartment complex. And it was so revolutionary at the time. What gave you the confidence, and what was the thought process behind that?
Well, it emerged out of a traveling fellowship I had as a student at McGill to study housing across the continent, North America. And we visited many suburbs. Levittown was sort of in its heyday. And this was 59, and then there were endless public housing projects of high-rise apartments built by the authorities, which were really places that seemed to me like prisons, like they were very inhuman. And I started kind of conjuring the idea that we could solve the paradox between the two by inventing a new building type where we reinvent apartment buildings so that it's like living in a house. If you could give people a garden, if you made streets instead of corridors, if there was open space and light and sun, then people would not mind living in high-rise buildings so that that pull to the suburbs would be neutralized. So I set as my thesis to do just that. And I started piling up one house on top of the other and making gardens. And out of it came the kind of concept that piling up houses as family units, and then emerged Habitat, which then I built for the World's Fair.
And 50 years after, it's still serving as an inspiration for like so many different projects. So one of them in Toronto, Bjarke Ingels, is trying to create something paying homage to you. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it's fascinating that right after Habitat was built, I was quite criticized. It's impractical. It won't proliferate. It's sort of a one-timer. Many Habitats that I designed didn't get built. And here we are 50 years later, in the work of Bjarke, in the work of Herzog de Mouron, in the work of many other young architects, the ideas of Habitat are coming to life, and some of them are even acknowledging it. So it's in a kind of affirmation that the principles that led to Habitat are fresh and meaningful and alive, and you just got to live long enough to see it happen, 50 years to be exact.
Definitely very enduring, especially now, and more people want to live within cities. There's this desire for cities to be livable. And I know that's something you think a lot about, how to make dense living or density manageable. Can you tell me a little bit about the criteria or what you think about when you think about something like this?
Well, I thought when I designed Habitat that I was dealing with dense housing. And then, of course, decades later, here I am in Asia, in Singapore, in Shanghai, in Chongqing. And the densities are 10, 20, 30 times anything we imagined. And so now I'm trying to see whether these principles of gardens, of open space, of giving the individual family an identity and still getting the sense of the community. It's still the collective. It's not corridors with lots of cell blocks of people living along them, but somehow framed around communal life. And so the project I built here in Bishan called Sky Habitat actually demonstrates that it is a community. It's 5 times and 10 times the density of Habitat. And I do that by providing a lot of common spaces, outdoors, terraces, bridges, roof gardens, not just for the individual families, but for the community as a whole.
You've mentioned before one of your driving forces of how you approach new projects is inspired by your mentor, Louis Kahn, about let the building be what it wants to be. Can you explain what that means?
I think that Kahn's very poetic framing had to do with the fact that buildings have a will of their own. If you're designing a school, the only thing that matters is it a wonderful place for learning? Is it a great environment for teachers and students? And what makes a great environment? Does it have the right kind of spaces, the mood, the light? There was a moment where people said, well, schools don't need windows. The most stupid idea anybody ever could imagine, because, you know, that is not conducive to learning. You need a contact with nature. So Kahn was saying, go back to the essence of the program, the brief, as the British call it, the program. Go to the essence of it and let that be the inspiration for a design rather than just abstract form making and shape and geometry. Yes, there is shape, geometry, they're all very important, but they ought to grow out of the essence of the program.
You've designed so many things, buildings for so many purposes, from libraries to memorials. How do you choose your commissions?
You know, we choose commissions and they choose us. Louis Sullivan, great American architect, said, no great buildings without great clients, and clients get the architects they deserve. So people come to you because they respect what you do. That's already a selective process. And when you see that the program, the purpose of the building, the site, and the objective of the clients resonate with yours, that's the moment to step in. So sometimes, you're offered commissions where you know it's a losing battle. For one of those ingredients isn't there, and you're not going to be able to achieve it. And so then you need to know to say no. But I would say that for me, I love doing something I haven't done before. My first airport, my first museum, my first library, now my first hospital. It's always like you're going back to first principles. You're inventing a new something from a tabula rasa. You take nothing for granted. I like working in very exciting, beautiful sites, whether it's part of nature or whether they're urban. Cities with a historic heritage, on sites that have deeper meaning than just a site. I love working with clients who inspire me and push me to do better.
That was Monocle's Jason Lee speaking with the legendary architect Moshi Safdie. And on the subject of the legendary, I'm joined in a very cold Studio One right here in Midori House by Monocle 24's legendary producer and this show's producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan.
Hello, Josh.
What an introduction.
I can't possibly live up to that.
It was rather rambling. I've stopped you getting a jumper because I said that this show needed to be recorded in a timely fashion. How are you feeling?
Cold, but actually now invigorated, I have to say.
Having listened to the Moshi Safdie interview by our very own Jason Lee.
Invigorated by the interview and invigorated by the temperature having acclimatized somewhat. But no, mainly by the interview, of course. Let's focus on that. I thought it was a really great chat. One thing that I was really interested in was Moshe's reflections on his upbringing in the kibbutz culture of early Israel, and just thinking about how that influenced his approach to particularly his work that aims to try to alleviate some of the pressures of high-density living in cities, most famously Habitat 67. I think it's worth noting how ideological the architects who constructed the likes of Habitat 67, the likes of the Barbican in London, these kind of 20th century modernist projects, which in recent years have become very sexy again and, you know, have been appreciated on an aesthetic level like never before. But I feel perhaps we might have lost sight of the principles that led them to be designed in the first place. So, you know, on the one hand, we have all sorts of events appreciating these sites and design tourists heading to them, whilst all around them, the kind of same old crap that we've been knocking up in terms of urban housing is going up all around them. We need to apply the principles of these behind these buildings as well as appreciating them. But I also spoke to a guy last week, an author and broadcaster called Mark Ovenden, a really interesting guy. He's just written a book all about the British typographers, Edward Johnson and Eric Gill. Now, anyone who's used Transport for London services, anyone who's watched a BBC programme in recent years or picked up a classic Penguin paperback will be familiar with the work of these two, though they may not know it. They were around in the late 19th and first half of the 20th century, designing some of the most influential sans serif typefaces. Really interesting backgrounds. Yeah, Mark's written a book which is the first comprehensive look at the development of their work and its influence in tandem. So I sat down in the studio to have a chat with him.
Edward Johnston was a calligrapher. He produced these wonderful handwritten, formal handwriting pieces of paper for special events or for opening different exhibitions or for nice books or whatever. And it was all done by hand. He wasn't really a type designer. But he ended up running this class in central London to teach people how to write. And one of his students was a young fellow called Eric Gill, who himself wasn't a type designer either. He was originally an architect, and he was already chiseling fantastic inscriptions into stone. And so the two became quite good friends. We're talking around about the early 1900s here. And they developed a set of people who liked to go out and look at lettering in public. And to be honest, at the turn of the 20th century, it was a bit of a mess. There was a lot of very shouty, loud block letters around, clamouring for attention. We didn't have anything that we've got now. We didn't have the wonderful medium of radio. We didn't have film or media or internet or anything else. So everything had to be done in the written word, mainly in the street. So there were these massive big hoardings over everything, on the sides of buildings. Everywhere you looked, there were big, shouty letters. And in the background to all this, the London Underground was expanding quite rapidly. And they employed a chap called Frank Pick, who was a very bright spark and was aware of new developments in Europe, even took his bosses on tours across Europe to look at architecture and signage and lettering in other parts of near Europe, particularly impressed with Berlin and Amsterdam. And they saw that there was an evolving way of making lettering for the underground, which they could use for their underground stations, which didn't really exist here at this point. And so Pick was looking around for someone to commission to do this new kind of lettering for the London Underground originally.
And he found Johnson and Gill.
He was aware of them through a thing that he was involved in called the Design and Industries Association, which began around 1913, 14, 15. And he was aware of Johnston's work. And even though he wasn't a typeface designer or naturally a lettering designer, certainly of a sans serif letter, which was what Pick was looking for, he was striving for a very clear, authoritative shape to go on his stations. And they weren't the natural people, but he was aware of his work. And so he originally called both Johnson and Gill in for a meeting to talk about what he called block letters. He had a pretty good idea in his mind what he wanted these letters to look like, to carry the weight and the authority that would stand out in a station environment and could be seen perhaps in slightly dim lighting on the early underground stations where things weren't as bright as they are today with modern lighting. And he also didn't want the lettering to be confused with the lettering used on the posters, which was a big source of income for the underground even then. So he wanted something that was very distinctive and very London. And so eventually he commissioned Johnson and Gill. Gill wasn't able to help out on the project because he was busy carving his Stations of the Cross for Westminster Cathedral. So eventually Johnson took the project forward. And originally Johnson's first work had these little pointy serifs on the edge of, they were very clear block letters, but had little pointy serifs on. Pick didn't like it. This was in about 1916. And he asked Johnson to go away and look again at the lettering. And eventually Johnson came back in early 1916 with this incredibly clear shape, which basically has kind of been in existence and in use on London Underground first, and then the London buses, and eventually spread out to all of London's transport for a century.
Now, aside from its influence on the transport infrastructure of London, one of the points that you make in your book is that these typefaces initially developed by Johnson and Gill for the Underground have had a profound influence on design and typography beyond the Transport for London infrastructure, indeed beyond Britain. Can you talk a little bit more about how specifically they've influenced design and typography today?
Well, I think they have had an absolutely enormous influence on the way that graphic designers and typographers use this kind of lettering right around the world. You've got to remember that this original lot of lettering for the Underground was restricted for use only in London to begin with, on London Underground stations. But it immediately carried that weight, and people saw it, and they wanted to use something like it. And along came a man called Stanley Morrison, who was working for the Monotype Corporation at the time. And if he wanted to print something in those days, it was very difficult. We didn't have computers, and there were typewriters just produced literally typewritten letters. And so the Monotype Corporation had just invented this brand new machine, which was called the Supercaster, which was able to cast letters very quickly. And Morrison wanted to provide for them a kind of lettering which was modern and clear and a little bit like some of the German letters like Futura that were coming out at the time. And by chance, in 1927, he went down to Bristol and walked in to a relatively new bookshop which had a sign that had been painted for it by Eric Gill. And Gill had been inspired by the underground lettering and did his own kind of version, which he liked to think of as a little bit of an improvement on what Johnson had did. And Morrison saw this lettering and immediately thought, that's what I want for my new sans serif, for my new type, for my new machine, and commissioned Gill pretty much on the spot. Gill then went away and refined these letters into a full alphabet. He'd given a book of these letters already to the guy who ran the bookshop, and he made those better for Monotype. And in 1927, 1928, he started delivering these things to Monotype, based half in London and down at Red Hills in Surrey. And they put them through this fantastic process where they use this enormous, great big lens to make the letters really large and then shrink them down again to make these tiny little letters that were going to get printed. And what happened then is that the lettering that Eric Gill did was absolutely beautiful and almost indiscernible from Johnston, really. People who wanted to have a kind of Johnston kind of looking clarity about them, grabbed hold of it. The first people to take it up was the London and North Eastern Railway, which was quite a progressive railway group running up trains between here and the North Eastern Scotland, and they were quite competitive with the other railway groups that were around at the time. And they grasped hold of Gill Sands very early on. They were the first big ones to make a large order. And that then was rolled out across their stations. And of course, it looked very similar to the London lettering. It was very clear, and people started ordering it by the ton. And within 10 years, it was virtually everywhere. Printers all over Britain had trays full of this metal Gill Sands type and on their monotype machines. And that's how it started spreading out.
Mark Ovenden there, talking about his new book, Johnson and Gill, Very British Typefaces. It's published in the UK by Lund Humphreys on November the 29th and available thereafter. Now, design professionals know the daily grind of the trade show circuit, and there's some irony in the fact that these spaces are rarely eye-catching or enriching affairs to behold. Too often, trade shows from Milan to Miami are the realm of stale sandwiches, grey coffee and ugly booths. The conference centres in which they're held are willfully bland, and the temporary spaces installed by companies touting their wares are too often garish or flimsy. Now, Henry Rees Sheridan, you have first-hand experience of the shortcomings of a lot of these trade shows. I mean, a lot of our listeners will work in the industry. They might have to visit Milan in April or Miami in December. And for people not in the industry, that sounds very glamorous. But actually, you know, the airless trade show hall, the sad sandwiches, could do with a bit of a design revamp. Where have you been recently?
So, yeah, I mean, I suspect the standard is slightly higher when it comes to design-oriented trade shows. But I spend a lot of my time poking around the more esoteric trade shows on this fine continent. And I've recently just returned from MAPIC, Europe's largest retail property trade fair. Now, the design standard within what was popularly known as the bunker in Cannes was not particularly appetizing.
This for our listeners, you know, you see, you're coming across a little bit ungrateful here. This is where the Cannes Film Festival is held. This is where MIPIM, the property trade show every March, is held. Just off La Croisette, a beautiful short train ride from Nice. You know, I've been there. I didn't find it so ho-hum. I thought it was fine.
Were you in the conference centre?
I've been in the conference centre, yeah, for MIPIM, I think 3 years ago.
Okay. And you didn't mind. I tell you what I didn't mind, and which I was quite impressed by, which was the standard of the free confectionery that was being distributed at the booths.
That was confectionery,
and it was of a higher standard than a Spielwarenmesse, Europe's largest toy fair, that I went to earlier in the year. But as I walked through the fair, you know, it was the same kind of fairly garish, and I think flimsy would be the word I'd use to describe it. You know, the stalls felt temporary, except for one which really jumped out, and this was, it was labelled the Nordic Pavilion, but it was put together by the Nordic Council of Shopping Centres, and it was designed by a guy called Alessandro Cardinale. He was an Italian guy who'd moved to Sweden and worked in an architect in Stockholm. And first of all, they'd actually got an architect to design this, which I think was a really bold move. And it was these kind of charcoal grey benches and tables laid out in such a way that it enabled patrons to the Nordic Pavilion to have lots of different types of meetings, from the very intimate to the very convivial. And it was just really impressive and stuck out a lot. So I had a chat with him in the pavilion itself and talked to him a bit about the design behind it, the ideas behind it, and what, you know, you can add to a trade show by really being thoughtful about it.
We had the opportunity to show for everyone and to create a place for everyone involved in the industry at MAPIC, and we thought it was an amazing chance to take and to show also that the North is not only about light, about forest, about snow and reindeers. It's about an industry that's very strong, very stable, and we put in all these keywords in what we have seen as needed to promote the Nordic market for new upcoming investment. And the whole concept built on facilitating meeting and create space for every kind of meeting. A big meeting with lots of people involved, or a more sensitive meeting, a more spontaneous meeting, and finding the right feature that facilitates the meeting. So we put, for example, lamps on each tables where you can charge and connect your iPad or your phone while you're sitting and working. And this is something that we ourselves felt the need of. And when we got the chance to design the stand, we thought it was an obvious choice. We love that every part of the stand are activated now, and we see that lots of the business are happening into the stand, while before were people trying to meet here and bringing the business and the meeting, the sensitive discussion somewhere else. So now it's still lots of people here.
I really love it. It really jumped out at me when I was walking through the fair. And I really like the way that you've managed to create so many different types of space for meeting. We're sitting on a kind of tiered bench, which facilitates more intimate meetings, but there's also a kind of central bench where people can gather around and have a drink and tables for smaller groups. And you've managed to achieve this very simple materials, kind of a charcoal wood, it looks like, and mirroring in a completely open space. So who approached you to do this, and what do you think motivated them?
The project comes from the Nordic Council of Shopping Center, that is our organization in the business. And of course, they needed a new design for the new stand. And our approach has been trying to sell in not only a normal stand, the stand as they always had, but also trying to get something different out of it. And thanks to our experience of activity-based working place, we actually succeeded to sell in something that is quite unique. Before, every company, they had their own session, their own part, their own table, their own two chairs that were actually defined for each company.
So each company, which is part of the Nordic Council, yes, had their own stand.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Or their own table inside the stand. And now is that you bring your own bag in metal with your own brochure around the stand, so you can choose and bring with you your brand to the best table that you find for that meeting. So it's a kind of free sitting and activities sitting that makes also lots of variation and lots of happening and into the stand. It is not any more like static.
Why are most trade show stalls so rubbish?
I can't. It's a quite tough thing to say. I think there's lots of money put in, and I think it's very often I don't think it's following what actually is the picture of the company that people wants to give. It's more like a separate assignment, not connected to what actually they want to do.
I mean, who designs them generally? You're an architect by trade.
Yes, I'm an architect.
I mean, do architects generally design trade show stalls?
Yes, we do, but not every company understands that it should be an architect doing it. Very often it's other company that just propose a kind of design, and that would be any kind of design for any kind of company. We want to do the right design for just that company with that aim and that situation. So we always start from a quite specific assignment, while those company want to try to sell like a solution that will fit many. So I think it's a pity, where obviously there's economy behind that, but I don't think they get out of it the most of it. So it's a pity.
That was Alessandro Cardinale from the Swedish Practice Studio Stockholm talking about the Nordic Pavilion at the MAPIC Retail Property Trade Show in Cannes, which wrapped up last week. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, the show's producer, Henry Rees Sheridan, and the girl behind the glass, Claire Urban, this week. If you have any comments or queries, then do feel free to drop Henry an email at hrs@monocle.com. And remember, we're back at the same time next week. That's 1900 London time. You can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud or iTunes. And please do leave us a review on the latter. It really helps people find the show. Don't forget to tune into our sister show on design, where we spend a few minutes each week unpicking an idea, place or person that's shaping the design industry today. And don't forget that that's Thursdays on Monocle 24. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.